Well, I'll stop. I don't suppose everybody's here. There'll be a few people turning up, but this is the session, Responses to the Green New Deal, which I hope is going to follow on from some of the interesting discussions you've had in the morning. We have two speakers. We have John Smith from the University of Sheffield, and we have Dr. Khalil from Birmingham, who's from the Islamic Ecology Foundation. So, I think it could be a lively session. I'm going to give the speakers no more than 20 minutes. Is that okay? So I'm going to be quite strict with the time, if I can, so that we can have some questions at the end. And I am going to try and finish a little bit before 3, because we're supposed to be in the next session by 3 and there's no tea break. So I'm going to try and finish at 5 to 3 so you can start moving on. So if you do have questions at the end, can they be brief questions? Okay. So I think John's going to start. Okay. Thank you, John.
Hello, everybody. First of all, University of Sheffield, well, I'm a PhD student at the University of Sheffield, so I don't want to actually masquerade as an academic. I've not actually passed anything yet. Or, hopefully, yeah, who knows what will happen. But I think, anyway, I'm sort of writing it up at the moment. And my particular area of research has been, or is, why it is that that capitalist firms in Europe, North America and Japan, by substituting relatively high-wage labour at home for low-wage labour in Bangladesh, China, Morocco, etc., how they have, by doing this, managed to postpone the inevitable onset of a crisis by maybe 20 years. It's one of the main things which they have done to actually postpone a crisis, which would have happened 20 years ago if it hadn't been for this. So that's the thing I'm particularly looking at. And I think it does have some relevance for the Green New Deal. So I actually submitted a little an abstract of a presentation, which the organisers of the conference decided on the basis of that to invite me along to do a talk. And the title of it was, "This is not a financial crisis, and it didn't begin last year or 2007. Right. So this is not a financial crisis, and it hasn't only just begun. In my view, this crisis really has been going on for quite a long time, and it's now reached a terminal stage. So the first thing I'd like to just explain is why it makes sense to actually talk about this crisis as something that's been going on for 2 decades, not just for 2 years. I'd use the analogy of We've now, it's now only a very advanced stage in the crisis. Does it manifest itself
in the morning?
The awareness in the patient collapsing on the
other.
In failure. We're in that stage of crisis. Now, the implication of that is that this crisis that we're in is terminal, that there is no cure for it, and I do believe that as well. There, the analogy with a living organism breaks down, because I think the crisis is not of the financial system. I'm going to come on to that in a minute. It's really a crisis of the capitalist system. And that capitalism really is not really a living organism. It preys on life.
Yeah.
It is self. Capital really is accumulating dead labour, which can be built by consuming, especially the labour,
Islamic
capitalist profits, their performance, like whether it's dividends of shares or rent and bonds or what catch respective all due from the fact that workers and farmers produce wealth,
lively
wage.
I'm going to give the speaker 20 minutes.
Just like vampires, the only way they can be killed is if a state is driven through its The only way it
is that,
can be...
Is that okay?
The contraction of the people that it preys on. Left to its own devices, it will regenerate, just like Doctor Who regenerates. But the way capitalism regenerates is through fascism and world war. If we don't want that to happen, then we have to drive the stake through its heart, and we have to create a new, completely new mode of production. So that's why I think this crisis did not just happen. Just trying to get on to the particular thing of that this is not a financial crisis. Of course, there is a financial crisis. But I want to suggest that the real fundamental cause of the crisis we're in is a crisis that has its roots in the real economy, in inverted commas, what they call the real economy, in the actual production of things, not in the financial world, not in the banking system. And if we go back 20 years, we can see that really what we found, what we would find if you look at just about any sector of industry, or agriculture for that matter, too many cars being produced, too many ships, too much milk, too much beef, too much wine, an overproduction crisis everywhere you see. The way that this is, of course, an overproduction crisis, not relative to human need, but relative to the capacity of consumers to pay a price which will allow the total product to be sold at a profit. The way that the capitalist system, the way that Europe and North America and Japan confronted this crisis coming out of the 1970s, was to adopt two strategic responses to it, which have helped to delay the outbreak of the crisis until now. One of them I've just mentioned before, and that is the substitution of relatively high-wage labour for low-wage labour through a massive increase in super-exploitation of Chinese, Bangladeshi, Moroccan, etc. workers. And the other is through massive expansion of debt. And by expanding debt, it actually makes up for this deficit of demand. It provides an artificial boost to demand. So therefore, you can see we have one root of the crisis in the real production system, two strategic responses to it, one of which is given some recognition, and that is the expansion of debt. What is not really asked is why this debt was expanded and what would have happened if they hadn't expanded debt. And that is, if they hadn't expanded debt, if they hadn't relaxed credit conditions, if they hadn't said, buy this car off us and don't begin to pay for 15 months and then we'll only charge you 0% interest, if they hadn't come up with all of these things, they would not have been able to shift their products. And the overproduction crisis would have manifested itself. And at every single point over the past 20 years, the employers and governments in the rich countries have been stalked by this fear that if they didn't slash interest rates at the first sign of a recession, the recession would take hold and develop a momentum of its own, and we'd soon be in a Japanese-type situation. In Japan, just to remind you, they went into depression there. At the beginning of the depression, government debt was 10% of GDP. It's now 180% of GDP. Japan has been very successful in preventing a slump. But the only reason they've been able to succeed in that is because the rest of the world economy was not suffering from the condition that Japan was suffering from. Now, the whole of the world economy is gripped by this crisis. What Japan was unable to completely push in the shadows is now breaking out across the world. So therefore, the idea I'm trying to put across to you is that the crisis really begins in the real, so-called real economy, in the way capitalism produces things, and in its inherent tendency to overproduction. The response of governments and firms to this situation, a combination of outsourcing, of replacing relatively high-wage labour for low-wage labour, which allows them to maintain profit levels for another 20 years, and also through a massive increase of debt. Those two things together have helped to postpone the outbreak of this crisis by 20 years. So then we have a third factor, or something else that then starts to happen, and that is developments in the sphere of finance itself. The combination, in some ways, the interaction between outsourcing on the one hand and the massive growth of debt on the other. And that is that, I think the best way to sort of, and this is the financial crisis as such. So what I'm saying so far is that all of the measures that they've taken to try and prevent an overproduction crisis from manifesting itself, from breaking out, all of those measures have resulted in
on destabilising the financial system. So the collapse of the financial system itself is a result of measures taken to deal with another problem whose location is elsewhere. We then have this situation where the sequence of events is that we first of all have a financial crisis breaking out. That leads to consumers cutting back on their spending, both because their confidence drops and they want to start saving money instead of spending it, and also because they don't have access to credit, so they simply literally can't continue to consume in the way they did. So in other words, it moves from a financial crisis to a commercial crisis, with actual spending moving from Wall Street to the high street, in the way it's talked about in the newspapers. And then it results in high street reducing their orders to the factories, and you find then a big drop of production. So the sequence of events is the financial crisis appears to cause a commercial crisis, which appears to cause a crisis in the so-called real economy and a drop of production. What I'm arguing is that the real causation is the opposite of this. The real cause of the crisis only appears on the surface of the events as the last acts. And that is one of the reasons why everybody, all the commentators and the pundits, just fall into the mistake of thinking it's a financial crisis. And I would say that this is one of the biggest problems, one of the many problems, in my opinion, with the Green New Deal report, which locates the crisis entirely in the financial sector and talks about a golden age leading up to this, which we could talk about how much of a golden age there was for much of the world. But the point is, I'm saying, is that the developments during that period inevitably led to the crisis, which, and in other words, I think the Green New Deal report is mistaken to talk about the crisis being rooted in a particular model of globalisation rather than being rooted in the capitalist system itself. So, that's talking about it's not a financial crisis. I wanted to then say something about the financial crisis itself. I think one of the best ways to understand what's happening is is to understand asset stripping, what happens when what we mean by the term asset stripping. And you can easily understand what is meant by the term asset stripping if you imagine equity release on a house. If you've got a house, basically asset stripping is converting a store of wealth into a stream of income, right? It's converting an asset into an income stream. So if you take asset release on your house, it means you're converting the equity that you've got in your house represents your accumulated wealth. What you do is to develop an income stream from this to finance increased consumption today at the cost of going into greater debt. In many ways, that's really what all this sort of explosion of derivatives and sort of financial engineering is all about. It's converting asset bubbles, converting growing assets into streams of income to finance consumption. And it really is all about mortgaging the future, just in the same way that when you mortgage your house, you think you can afford to pay the increased interest payments. And so you've got this situation then, when the value of an asset is greater, the easier you can convert it into a stream of income. So the more you can cannibalise, the more you can strip your asset, the more you can cannibalise it, the bigger the asset grows. It's like this amazing sort of thing where the more you eat its flesh, the more flesh it seems to have on it. And that, of course, has reached its limit now, and we have the crisis. So in many ways, so what I'm trying to say is that it's not, I'm not trying to say that there isn't a financial crisis. There is one. It's a huge aggravation. It's aggravating enormously a pre-existing crisis. But at root, it is the response to a deeper rooted crisis that's not located in the financial system. Now, I just wanted to finish off by saying, by saying a few things. I've only got a few minutes left. Saying a few things about the original New Deal and the concept of New Deal, because I have some problems with this as well. First of all, Roosevelt was a very clever capitalist politician, and what was taking place after the shock of the crash in 1929 was that you had extremely powerful radicalisation taking place amongst working people in the United States. You had hunger marches and you had powerful labour movement struggles that were developing. Amongst the most famous were the Teamsters strikes in Minneapolis the dockers, the longshore workers of the West Coast, and there were this enormous growth in labour struggles. Basically, what the New Deal was an attempt to head off a social explosion in the United States, to co-opt a movement, to try and make concessions to a radicalised movement of working people, to try and save dying American capitalism. And if we actually look at the the measures which the New Deal brought in, unemployment had reached 25% by 1933. You had a 50% decline in industrial production between 1929 and 1933. The most that the New Deal ever employed in work projects was 25% of the total unemployed population. Three quarters of those who had lost their jobs during the Depression never got any work from the unemployment program. The wages that were being paid to the workers in the works project administration, the WPA programs, was described by the Unemployment League in the United States at the time as not enough to live on, but just too much to die on. They were starvation wages that were being paid. And as soon as the 1936 election was out of the way, Roosevelt sacked 500,000 of them and sharply moved to the right and began preparations for World War II. And it was really war production, not the New Deal, which, in inverted commas, rescued the US economy. There was an extremely severe economic crash from 1929 to 1933. From 1933 to 1936, there was a temporary upturn in the economy. It was a temporary upturn in the economy. 1937, you had another sharp crash, which showed that the New Deal hadn't actually solved the underlying problems of the US capitalist economy. What it had done is to co-opt and defuse a potentially revolutionary crisis in the United States. I could say other things about the... I mean, the one thing that was stated by Colin Hines this morning was that the New Deal actually, amongst other things, brought in right to organise. Actually, it was Hoover's administration the year before that actually enacted the right to organise. And sure enough, Roosevelt did actually continue that, and it was under pressure from the struggles of labour in the United States. The point about this is that the idea of a New Deal is, it seems to me, is like it's proposing a historic compromise between capital and labour. And right now, just as in the 30s, it's the very last time that we should be thinking about a historic compromise between capital and labour. What we need urgently in Britain and in every other country in the world is a government as committed to our class, as committed to the interests of working people, as our present government is committed to the interests of big banks. And in other words, we have to see that our interests are not, I think the it's not that our interests are completely opposed to the interests of bankers. Our interests are completely interests to the owners of capital. That's whether we like it or not the situation. And to finish, I'd just say that I think the very best part of the Green New Deal report is the reference to, is this extended reference to Cuba. And I think Cuba is an extremely important reference point for us. One thing it doesn't say in the Green New Deal report is that according to the Living Planet report of 2006 that the World Wildlife Fund produced, they produced this fantastic graphic, and if I was going to show any graphics, I'd show you this one. But if you can imagine all of the countries on Earth plotted onto a graph. Along the horizontal axis, you've got Human Development Index, which is a United Nations construct which talks about life expectancy, access to health and education, and so on. That's along the horizontal axis. The vertical axis is carbon footprint, right? They put a dotted line horizontally, which shows that if you're above that dotted line, then you are unsustainable, right? And they put a vertical dotted line, and if you're on the right-hand side of that dotted line, then it means you're providing high human development to your citizens. In the whole of the world, there's only one country which succeeds in providing a high human development index to its population, and to do so below that dotted line, to do so sustainably, and that is Cuba. And it is no accident that Cuba made a social revolution. If we are going to solve the problems in the world today, we have to do the same thing. And one of the great things about Cuba is its internationalism, about how it tries to share its what little it's got, even during the worst period of the economic crisis of the past 10, 15 years. They did not cut back at all on their absolutely extraordinary foreign aid. It should be said, it's not known in this country that widely, but when the Kashmir earthquake hit, for instance, 3/4 of all of the foreign aid which was sent into Kashmir from the whole of the outside world came from Cuba. Cuba has more doctors combating AIDS in Africa than the whole of the rest of the world. They don't trumpet the thing, they just let it be spoken of. But recently, 1,300,000 people, I'll just finish on this one last thing, because it's good news. I'd like to finish on some good news. They've carried out this project with Venezuela of giving free cataract operations to people who are blind. If you're suffering from a cataract and you don't get it fixed, basically it's because you're too poor to afford the relatively simple operation. They have restored eyesight free of charge to 1,300,000 people in the Caribbean and the Andean countries of the Americas. That's 1,300,000 people, all of whom have got relatives, friends and community and people who know. And it is the whole of Latin America is talking about it. And it's one of the reasons why the United States is losing the battle of hearts and minds in that particular part of the world. That's the sort of internationalism, international cooperation. We need more globalization. The Cuban slogan is globalized solidarity. With that spirit, and only with that spirit, can we solve these problems that are confronting humanity. Thanks.
Thank you very much, John. It's given us a lot to talk about, I guess. If you could save your questions until our second speaker, and hopefully I'm going to save us a bit of time. Thank you.
Good afternoon. John, you and I are going to do a bit of jostling here. Hope it doesn't turn into a punch-up. You said two things. One was, it's not financial. Probably financial. It's not new. I agree with one of those statements. Yeah, so John began with making two statements. John, it's not financial. And he said, it's not new. I agree with the second statement. There's nothing new about this, but I would say it is financial. At the end of the 15 or 20 minutes, I hope I'll have convinced you that this is the case. 2 weeks ago, I had the experience of being in two totally different spaces. First week in February, I was in the northern island of Zanzibar, which is called Pemba, and you couldn't find a more desperately poor place. We had a project there working with fishermen, and I was also told that the beaches surrounding the entire island were all beholden to hotel companies. So people are moving in there, trying to change a lifestyle where people are trying to sustain themselves, and introducing a totally globalized economic system which people are not familiar with and which will have the final effect of totally destroying their cultures and the local situation. 1 week later, I was in Dubai. Dubai, 1 year ago, was the world's largest construction site. Today, it has the world's largest market second-hand construction equipment. Because the whole thing has just collapsed. It's nothing there. So there's two kinds of developments. I mean, people in the Arab Gulf, United Arab Emirates, are known as the rich developing countries, part of the rich developing country. Lots of resources are there developing. From being a nomadic people just 30 years ago, they have compressed the Industrial Revolution, which has taken the West over 300 years, into 30 years. And it's created enormous social problems. The gloss of it is that they've got tall buildings, they've got motor cars, motorways, 8-lane motorways, and so on and so on. I would like to put to you and to the people who've written the Green New Deal that if you don't think completely out of the box, you're not going to get out of this situation. What I'm really saying is that if you have a foundation on which you have built a house And if that thing is collapsing, it is not enough to modify that place by putting maybe plastic windows and double glazing and sealing it against draft, which, with the greatest respect, I would say, this is what the Green New Deal is attempting to do. I know exactly where they're coming from, and I would say there is an element of incrementalism. We cannot be that radical in the sense of imagining a total environmental, social, ecological collapse and prepare for that scenario because the population just wouldn't take it. They wouldn't know how. So I'm with the Green New Deal in the sense that it is incremental. It does not deal with the problem. If I heard you right, Colin, I think you said it was about creating employment. I think you said at the end, creating jobs. Did I get that right?
Yeah.
In that sense, yes, fine. I have no... That's what people need, you see. But the whole idea of industrialization, factories, jobs, and that kind of wage slaves, it's new. It's new in terms of the way the human community has evolved. In terms of the clock, the 24-hour clock of human existence, it is a minuscule second, that's all. So what we have got here, it's only a minute time of existence in human history. We've done this in just 250 years. From being an agrarian, okay, say you want to go back to the future, that's another argument. What I'm really saying to you is the growth has been exponential. We have grown so fast, so quickly, we don't know how to deal with it. And at the same time, now we are looking to go back into communities, into self-sustaining communities, into living in social harmony together as people of the community, looking at local produce, selling produce to each other, all these kinds of things. Now, we are really trying to reinvent the wheel, what has already happened in the past. So it is going back to the future. So we've done this because of capital. The banks did not exist. The banks did not exist before. When was the Bank of England established? 1692? 1692, thank you. 100 years ago. There were no banks before that. Why was it? You see, there has been no decolonization. Why was it that when every colonial country left by handing democracy over to the so-called the new states, India, Pakistan, Sri Lanka, Bangladesh, Malaysia, so on, every country had a central bank. You see, and the central banks were not independent. They were locked into the major financial system, and they were well and truly locked into it after Bretton Woods. You see? And then what happened at Bretton Woods was that the United States was given the responsibility of locking the dollar into gold, and everybody else followed the dollar. What happened in 1972? Because de-gold threatened to cash in the euro dollars with the Marshall Plan, was that Nixon de-linked the dollar from gold. From there, there was no datum. Money had no datum. So what are the three economic conditions of money? Portability, store of value. What else is the third one? Portability, store of value, accountability. Money is not any longer a store of value, although it is still stored in the universities. It does not store value. It changes. So what I'm really saying is that we have to think outside the box, in that you cannot, somebody reminded me that Einstein said this as well, that the thinking that created the problem cannot solve the problem. I'm afraid we are still in that box. The problem is, I'm talking environmentally, ecologically, and socially, the whole thing, the change thing, is the financial system, in that problem is the fractional reserve banking system. Why? Because the fractional reserve banking system creates money exponentially to infinity. Anybody want to argue with that? Ask an AL student, he'll tell you that. The fractional reserve banking system, this is what they're doing now. Idea of printing money because people can go and spend it. But the planet is finite, my friends. The planet is finite. But we can create money to infinity. This is the problem, John. That is what allows us. You can build an industrial system and talk about trade unions and the conflict they'll have with the boss of the industry. I'm aware of that. You see, but ourselves as trade unionists and the bosses, we are in the same boat. Even Cuba, all the different kind of managing its affairs, and we can agree with a lot of that. But the problem, if you really want to change the system, you've got to look at that. You see, what I'm really positing is lifestyle change. No, it's difficult. Politicians won't sell that. This is why it's difficult for the Green Party to gain an electoral foothold in this country, because they talk a different language. What happened in Germany was, what happened to the Greens there? They got into a coalition with the last government. What happened? They had to dilute their policies, didn't they? You see, so it's big time. It's something totally different. We are experiencing something. The financial meltdown is a result of irresponsible people riding on the backs of others who became fodder eventually, the subprime mortgage, packaging things, futures trading, hedging, all these things invented. Even the banking experts didn't know what they were talking about. All these financial instruments that were created. It is possible. But the fact of the matter is that this whole society functions on debt. This whole society functions on debt. Every single coin and note we have in our pocket is a debt. Debt to somebody else, to the Bank of England. The Bank of England are all also in debt. Now they are printing money. You see, so one of the things that I hear from all of you, you know this, is that we need to get the consumers to come out and spend the money so that consumers having money, first of all, can spend it, and then there will be economic regeneration. People can get work. The factories will start working. The mines will start working. But all this has to come from somewhere. And it only comes from one place, underneath your feet. So what I'm really saying is that if we carry on like this, what are we going to leave our grandchildren? Peak oil is coming. My grandchildren will not have the pleasure of enjoying this kind of lighting by the time they're my age. We will have consumed it for them. So what I'm saying, and we need to think way ahead. NEF is doing a fantastic job. There was no NEF people have to create one. Okay, I used to know James Robertson, he's a good friend of mine. He's still around?
Yeah.
He's great. Okay.
Deaf now.
You bet deaf. Well, there was no NEF, but we need that kind of thinking.
What
radical.
The NEF is, sorry.
Sorry?
What the NEF is?
The New Economics Foundation. Yeah. There has to be people who think like this, and think radically forward. What I'm really saying, I'm trying to push NEF even further. So, you know, you need to look at the very basic issue that causes problems. And a wise old man once said to me many years ago, democracy is a service industry of the banks. I don't have to explain it. 1 year ago, I had to explain it. Now I don't have to explain it. You know now. So we talk about democracy. What kind of democracy? Democracy is great, but it has been manipulated. You see? And we are still being manipulated. This thing called democracy, as we know now, only functions because the banks can supply the credit.
That's all. So we need to think of another kind of democracy that is not dependent on somebody else insisting that we fall in debt so that we can be consumers and keep the industrial machine rolling and then dig all the finite resources out of the earth. Finance. That's all right. So you see, this comes back from, for me as a Muslim, it takes me back to the roots of what my faith has to say to me. You probably, people say Islam is peace. Okay, Islam is peace. But there's a more fundamental meaning to Islam and peace, which means submission. It means submitting to the will of the Creator. But speaking for myself, what I know that I do in the natural world today, because I have lost consciousness of the fact that I belong to something much superior to me, the natural world. How many of us have that consciousness in our beings that we are minuscule things of something vast, greater than us? So we dominate it. This whole thing, this whole civilization is about domination, of dominating the natural world in order that we may extract things out of it and consume our heart's desire thanks to the banks. But Islam tells me that I have to submit because I am this small little thing in this big, vast aspect of creation that I have to protect, that I have to nurture, that is nurturing me. I'm in the womb of something else, and I have to behave in it according to certain rules. If you have been listening, thank you.
Make compost, not wall.
Well, we've got 15 minutes for questions, yeah. So I think I'll do the conventional way. I'll take one question at a time. Who you want to ask a question to? Again, can you keep your questions short, please, and make sure they're questions?
Okay, first question. My question is to both of you. Because you've both talked about quite radical things. You talked about a revolution, I think was the word you used, and you talked about thinking outside the box. But I think not everybody is that forward-thinking or understands things well enough to know what the solutions might be. So where does that leave the rest of us? How do we work with what we've got when you're just trying to improve things on a day-to-day basis?
Well, you have to work with what you've got. And I think the first thing to do is raising awareness. And for me, coming here and sharing my thoughts and listening to what other people have to say, fresh ideas, and I think the morning session. And I've learned a tremendous amount. So we have to take this information and go back to our communities. You see, the old thing about cliche about thinking global and acting local. We are where we are. We have to act local. And as far as myself as a Muslim is concerned, and I think my job is to go to the mosques and talk to the imam and say, well, you know, what are you doing? Are you aware of what is going on? Is it challenged? You challenge the people who are close to me. It's not easy.
Well, I'd say, I was in one of the workshops earlier on, one of the round tables about trade unions. It seemed appropriate to mention the same thing, and that is that in the newspapers there's been a lot of reports recently about Somali pirates, right? But I feel very angry about the way the newspapers have been reporting this, because I've also read, not in the newspapers but elsewhere, about how Western firms have been dumping extremely toxic waste in huge quantities off the coast of Somalia, and other Western firms have been stealing all the fish. And the result of this is that waste drums with leaking toxic residues are washing up on the Somali coast, causing gigantic health crisis for the people who've got no health facilities. The fishing industry, which provided protein for the local population, has been devastated by both the poisons and also by Western. Anyway, the point is that the only people who are going to stop the British and German and French companies evading expensive pollution controls, because it won't be the government, right? Because they're in the pockets of the big business. It will be the trade unions. It's the job of trade unions to enforce health and safety. It's the job of the workers to organise and to build their union organisations to ensure that these things are done. That's like a, it shows the sort of way we need to start acting to defend our collective interests as working people. And what we need to struggle for is a government. It's as an absolute emergency necessity to, for our very survival, for us to be able to stay in houses, for farmers to keep hold of their land, is that we need a government as committed to our class as Gordon Brown is to their class. So it's with that perspective, and I would say that the only way, you know, we need to start talking about ethics. For me, this sort of we need a sort of an ethics of solidarity, and it's summed up by Che Guevara, who I think is a real model for young and old people today. And one of his great sayings was that if you can feel a sense of rage every time you hear of an injustice anywhere in the world, then we are comrades. So it's, in other words, we've got to be looking out for each other, not just in our local community. If we've only got a horizon that goes as far as our local community, we are finished.
Thank you. Next question. I'll take Tim and then I'll come to Paul.
It's a question for Fenton. I'm interested in this idea about living off the living off debt and interest. So I just wonder, for me, I come from a big economics background, there's a differentiation between borrowing for consumption, consumer goods, and borrowing for example, a house. The whole basis of obviously me being able to have a mortgage for my house is that I can't afford a house when I maybe leave my family and want to set out when I'm 25. Therefore, I have to borrow for the future and pay it off over time. That seems to be sort of proper and reasonable thing to do. And I differentiate between that and the credit crisis caused by mass consumerism of consumer goods, where people are increasingly living off credit cards and fueling their own greed and aspiration. Do you draw that distinction, or have you got a different kind of critique?
I would say
I have a different critique.
Okay, I'd say that my teaching says you will not charge interest. It is totally forbidden. I wouldn't go on that road. But not only are we charging interest, we are charging interest. The interesting thing about property is that if you go to a bank, see, you're an economist, if I went to a bank manager and say, I want to buy that house over there, he says, okay, fine, I qualify for a mortgage, you can have 60% of the value of the house and gives me £100,000. But you know that £100,000 is only a ledger entry. He invents it. He invents it. He does not go to a pot of gold and say, here is £100,000, I'll keep it for you. It is a ledger entry. But what he does on that ledger entry, he charges me interest. Mm-hmm. Now that is utterly and totally unjust. He's charging me interest, something is created that does not exist. But then something else happens. Okay? Then I buy this house, and 5 years later I find, oh my goodness, I have an equity. Now that equity is notional. It only exists in people's heads. It is not value. It is value what other people give. There's no intrinsic value in it. So you take this notional amount and say, I go to the bank and say, oh, you gave me a loan 5 years ago, but now I have equity. But I want to buy a car. Can you give me another loan on the basis of the excess value of the property? So on this notional loan, he writes another ledger entry and he charges me interest. Now I go and buy a car. Comes out of nothing. You call that justice? That is not economic. So no wonder we are in this mess. So you multiply that. You make it even more complicated. And you invent hedge funds and this and that and the other. And bankers themselves don't know what they've invented.
I understand that. I'm just trying to see, from what you just said there, are you drawing a distinction or not? You're implying that you're not, that any kind of borrowing against interest is...
Absolutely, totally.
Totally.
Yeah.
The question then is, with the Islamic system,
yes,
as I understand it, you have administration fees. What then? I mean, I can agree with you on the sort of idea about borrowing off invisible money, if you like. But in principle, that what's the difference between...
You're talking about Islamic banking.
Yeah. Which is a conventional term.
Islamic banking is an oxymoron. I don't agree with it.
Okay, thank you. Clive had a question, and then can I come back to you after that?
Right, yes. My ego trip is that I'm a founder member of the Green Party, so the point about that is that I've been worrying about questions such as this conference is predicated on for 35 years, and I've come to conferences like this for more wisdom than I've got myself. But obviously I have some ideas which leads to a different question to each of you. What was obvious to me is that you've got to provide security for everybody if you're going to expect the population as a whole to accept what we, all who have come here, recognise as necessary. So I have been proposing a citizen's income for 35 years, an unconditional payment to everybody. Now, first, rather to John, it's a plea rather than a question, that to me, the citizen's income can actually defuse the old conflict between capital and labour. Now, obviously, I can't explain that. I'd like your comments on that possibility. Now, to puzzle out... It is this. When the $700 trillion rescue package for the American banks was suggested, I saw on television... a guy in downtown St. Louis put to an interviewer, said, well, if they want to stop this Wall Street crisis hitting Main Street, why don't they just give the money to all the individual Americans? And of course, the interview didn't have an answer. I wish somebody with more economic literacy than me actually addressed that point. You know, what? Instead of trying to save the banks, just give it to the people. Put some ecological rules in alongside it so they don't spend it on all the things we don't want them to spend it on. I'd like to know what the... I'm not claiming a panacea, I just want to know what would it do.
If you give it to all the people.
Brief answers, please, because we haven't got all day. Comment,
brief answer. I mean, before Roosevelt brought in his works project administration, giving starvation wages to people to lean on shovels, which is basically the symbol of the New Deal, was somebody leaning on a shovel. The unions and unemployed workers are demanding real jobs at union rates of pay. And I think that we should also be demanding that right now. Unemployment is a gigantic threat. It's going to rocket in this country and in Europe and around the world. And we should be demanding that instead of putting trillions of dollars to bail out bankers and loading up the public with gigantic debts, instead of doing that, the government should actually be providing jobs to tackle real problems at union rates of pay, and should be guaranteeing a living. If you're unemployed, you should not have to live on starvation rations. You should actually get... It's not your fault you're unemployed. So I think from that... But I just don't think that we can get those things and expect that there's going to be any kind of a relaxation of class antagonism, because the people who have money, they will fight tooth and nail against that. If they would accept it, then yes, we can have those things without defuse the capital labour conflict. But I'm just afraid that it's just wishful thinking to imagine that they will allow money to be used to bail out the ordinary people instead of at their expense. They will resist that, unfortunately, but we have to be realistic.
700 billion, is it?
Sorry?
700 billion?
Sorry?
$700 billion.
Well, what is a billion? A trillion? I can't remember now.
If you gave it to the bank,
sorry?
If you gave that money to the bank, they will give themselves very high pensions, and they will lend it to people at very high interest rates. The people will have to go and spend it then after having given the bank the interest rates. If you gave it to the people, it'll cut all that out. They'll go and spend the money. If they spend the money, all the shops will be open.
You're simply agreeing with them.
What? Spend the money. That seems to be a better way out, yes. Immediate spending power, giving spending power to the people.
Okay, we've got just that last lady, because then we're out of time.
Well, I'd just like to take something from what you both said, which I thought was really good, was that you talked about a different kind of consciousness in terms of our relationship to the world
and the
world we live in. And you, John, talked about different kind of consciousness in relation to support and solidarity. And, you know, I'd just like to say, well, one of the things I appreciate about the, probably what the Green Party's been pushing for is the idea of sharing and being more conscious of how we relate to each other, how we use resources. I do think what's going to happen over the next few years is the people who work in this world who do the shipping jobs, the shipping wages are going to be really, really hammered hard. And I think our task is going to be what kind of support and solidarity we give to each other in terms of awareness of what people are going through, as well as the environment.
Okay, well, I think we'll leave that there because we've got to get to another workshop. So can we thank the speakers again and your participation as well. And I'm sure they're going to...